mean,
some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Bless you.
But
tonight we care, and it shows.
The law.
Of course. You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Second edition of Media Monarchy. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. It's November 3rd, 2006. Second episode. I'm stoked to be back. This episode is going to be jam-packed. Tons of news to go over. Everything from the upcoming election to war crimes and TSA and Bush losing his mind and all kinds of other stuff. I'm going to try and cram it all in. Fascism and Halliburton and Berlusconi and organ harvesting and all kinds of stuff. The biggest thing I got for you today is actually an exclusive recording of Wayne Madsen of WayneMadsenReport.com. He was at the First Unitarian Church Wednesday night here in downtown Portland, and he's actually here again tonight at 23rd Avenue Books, and I'll give you more information as we truck along. But let's jump right to the news, all the news that's fit to suppress. You can go to MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com for this and tons of news and views and videos and links and all kinds of things. Top story actually on here right now is me promoting this show. So as time goes by, I'm going to promote it a little more and more as I get my stuff together, my imaging, some commercials, and the podcasts and all that kind of stuff. It's going to be killer. So the first real story is Ron Paul versus the NAFTA superhighway, and this is coming from Op-Ed News. By now, many Texans have heard about the proposed NAFTA superhighway, which is also referred to as the Trans-Texas Corridor. What you may not know is the extent to which plans for such a superhighway are moving forward without congressional oversight or media attention. This superhighway would connect Mexico, the United States, and Canada, cutting a wide swath through the middle of Texas and up through Kansas City. Offshoots would connect the main artery to the West Coast, Florida, and Northeast. Proponents envision a 10-lane colossus the width of several football fields with freight and rail lines, fiber optic cable lines, and oil and natural gas pipelines running alongside. This will require coordinated federal and state eminent domain actions on an unprecedented scale, as literally millions of people and businesses could be displaced. The loss of whole communities is almost certain as planners cannot wind the highway around every quaint town, historic building, or senior citizen apartment for thousands of miles. Governor Rick Perry is a supporter of the superhighway project, and Congress has provided small amounts of money to study the proposal. Since this money was just one item in an enormous transportation appropriations bill, however, most members of Congress were not aware of it. The proposed highway is part of a broader plan advanced by a quasi-government organization called the Security and Prosperity Partnership, or SPP.gov. The SPP was first launched in 2005 by the heads of state of Canada, Mexico, and the United States at a summit in Waco, Texas. The SPP was not created by a treaty between the nations involved, nor was Congress involved in any way. Instead, the SPP is an unholy alliance of foreign consortiums and officials from several governments. One principal player is a Spanish construction company, Centra, which plans to build the highway and operate it as a toll road. But don't be fooled. The superhighway proposal is not the result of free market demand, but rather an extension of government-managed trade schemes like NAFTA that benefit politically connected interests. The real issue is national sovereignty. Once again, decisions that affect millions of Americans are not being made by those Americans themselves, or even by their elected representatives in Congress. Instead, a handful of elites use their government connections to bypass national legislatures and ignore our Constitution, which expressly grants Congress the sole authority to regulate international trade. The ultimate goal is not simply a superhighway, but an integrated North American Union, complete with a currency, a cross-national bureaucracy, and virtually borderless travel within the Union. Like the European Union, a North American Union would represent another step toward the abolition of national sovereignty altogether. A new resolution introduced by Representative Virgil Goode of Virginia expresses the sense of Congress that the United States should not engage in the construction of a NAFTA superhighway or enter into any agreement that advances the concept of a North American Union. I wholeheartedly support this legislation and predict that the superhighway will become a sleeper issue in the 2008 election. Any movement toward a North American Union diminishes the ability of average Americans to influence the laws under which they must live. The SPP agreement, including the plan for a major transnational superhighway through Texas, is moving forward without congressional oversight, and that is an outrage. The administration needs a strong message from Congress that the American people will not tolerate backroom deals that threaten our sovereignty. And that was written by Congressman Ron Paul of Texas. Next story, jumping to, is a sad one. Nun dies from 9/11 dust. This is coming from WNBC. A nun who worked at the World Trade Center site in the wake of the September 11th attacks died Wednesday after a battle with lung disease that she said stemmed from inhaling toxic dust at Ground Zero. Sister Cindy Mahoney had volunteered at Ground Zero to bless the remains of victims. Attorney David Warby said Mahoney, who was suffering from interstitial lung disease, hoped her story would help prove the connection between exposure to dust at the World Trade Center site and fatal illness. According to Warby, Mahoney requested that an autopsy be conducted after her death to prove that the toxic dust at Ground Zero made her sick. Warby, whose lawsuit against New York City was given a green light last month by a federal judge, said Mahoney's initial autopsy was conducted in South Carolina Wednesday, but that additional tissue samples would be tested in the coming weeks. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. James, you're listening to Media Monarchy for November 3rd, 2006. Our next story on Media Monarchy, ex-Bush backer says Prez has lost his mind. This is coming from editorandpublisher.com. In a move that no doubt sent a shiver through several candidates in his own party, President Bush, in a special interview with wire service reporters in the White House yesterday, guaranteed a job for his Pentagon chief for two more years, adding that both Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney, quote, are doing fantastic jobs and I strongly support them. But it wasn't only endangered Republicans who have been calling for Rumsfeld's ouster who may have blanched. Andrew Sullivan of AndrewSullivan.com, the conservative writer who was once a key media supporter for the Iraq War, denounced the latest Bush statement on CNN Wednesday night, stating that the president is so delusional, quote, this is not an election anymore, it's an intervention. Sullivan said the president was so in denial, comparing the Rumsfeld endorsement to applauding the job FEMA's Michael Brown did on Katrina. It's unhinged. It suggests this man has lost his mind. No one objectively could look at the guy this war has been at the way this war has been conducted, whether you were for it, as I was, or against it, and say that it has been done well. It's a disaster. For him to say it's a fantastic job suggests the president has lost it. I'm sorry, there's no other way to say it. These people must be held accountable. And that's Andrew Sullivan. He added that today Richard Perle, a leading neocon and Iraq war backer, had today called the administration dysfunctional. Representative John Bonner, the second-ranking Republican in the House, said also on CNN, quote, let's not blame what's happening in Iraq on Rumsfeld, but the fact is the generals on the ground are in charge and he works closely with them and the president. Our next story is called the TSA Follies, and this is coming from Homeland Stupidity, which is actually funny. Google News gives results for Homeland Stupidity, but they call it satire, which it is not. The Transportation Security Administration. Vigilant, effective, efficient. Yes, and pigs can fly too. Here are three examples of how the TSA is keeping you less secure and giving a good laugh to those of us with enough sense to stay away from airports as long as the government is in charge of security. In Miami, a dozen TSA officers from the graveyard shift were arrested and charged with grand theft and conspiracy to defraud last week after being caught not going to work and having their coworkers punch them in. If you can hand ID badges to different people, they can be handed off to the wrong people, Miami-Dade Detective Javier Perlazzo told the Miami Herald. The bottom line is we were looking at this as a security issue. We want this airport to be secure. Good luck with that. In Hawaii last week, an air passenger flying from Kona to Honolulu was shocked to open his duffel bag after getting home and finding a notebook labeled Explosive Trace Detection, full of TSA-sensitive security information, SSI, namely logs from an explosion detection machine in the bag he'd checked through. It makes me think, hey, what kind of people do we have working at TSA? Where they just accidentally leave this in a bag? Joe Langer told KITV he returned the notebook to the airport, but not before showing it to a television station. The kind of people who will do criminal background checks on the families of September 11th victims who are suing to gain access to SSI, they believe will be useful in their lawsuit against the airports and airlines for lax security, but will work while half asleep and stuff SSI into passengers' luggage and some days just not come into work. As if the 9/11 victims are going to turn around and become terrorists themselves. Ridiculous.
As far as I'm concerned, all of this airport security, all the searches, the screenings, the cameras, the questions, it's just one more way of reducing your liberty and reminding you that they can fuck with you anytime they want. As long as you put up with it. As long as you put up with it. Which means, of course, any time they want. Because that's what Americans do now. They're always willing to trade away a little of their freedom in exchange for the feeling, the illusion of security.
Why, thank you, George. That's very true, George Carlin. Our next story, Hirsch slams war crimes, and this is coming from the McGill Daily, and you can get all this stuff off of MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. Seymour Hirsch, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and regular contributor to The New Yorker, has been a thorn in the side of U.S. government for nearly 40 years, since his 1969 expose of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, which is widely believed to have helped turn American public opinion against the Vietnam War. He has broken news about the secret U.S. bombing of Cambodia, covert CIA attempts to overthrow Chilean President Salvador Allende, and more recently, the first details about American soldiers abusing prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Hirsch described video footage depicting U.S. atrocities in Iraq, which he had viewed but not yet published a story about. If Americans knew the full extent of U.S. criminal conduct, they would receive returning Iraqi veterans as they did Vietnam veterans, Hirsch says. In Vietnam, our soldiers came back and they were reviled as baby killers in shame and humiliation, he said. It isn't happening now, but I will tell you, there has never been an American army as violent and murderous as our army has been in Iraq. Hirsch came out hard against President Bush for his involvement in the Middle East. In Washington, you can't expect any rationality. I don't know if he's in Iraq because God told him to, because his father didn't do it, or because it's the next step in his 12-step Alcoholics Anonymous program, he said. Hirsch hinted that the responsibility for the invasion of Iraq lies with 8 or 9 members of the administration who have a neoconservative agenda and dictate the U.S.'s post-September 11th foreign policy. You have a collapsed Congress. You have a collapsed press. The military is going to do what the president wants, Hirsch said. How fragile is democracy in America if a president can come in with an agenda controlled by a few cultists? Throughout his talk, Hirsch remained pessimistic, predicting that the U.S. will initiate an attack against Iran and that the situation in Iraq will deteriorate further. There's no reason to see a change in a policy about Iraq. Bush thinks that in 20 years he's going to be recognized for the leader he was. The analogy he uses is Churchill, Hirsch said. If you read the public statements of the leadership, they're so confident and so calm, it's pretty scary.
Behind the wall.
own Decemberists with their new track When the War Came. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. This is our second episode, and it's November 3rd, 2006. Our next story, Can This Machine Be Trusted? And this is coming from Time. The U.S.'s new voting systems are only as good as the people who program them and use them, which is why next week could be interesting. More than 80 million Americans will go to the polls, and a record number of them, 90%, will either cast their vote on a computer or have it tabulated that way. When that many people collide with that many high-tech devices, there are going to be problems. Some will be machine malfunctions. Some could come from sabotage by poll workers or voters themselves. But in a venture this large, trouble is most likely to come from just plain human error, a fact often overlooked in an environment as charged and conspiratorial as America is in today. 4 years after Congress passed a law, that's the Help America Vote Act, requiring every state to vote by a method more reliable than the punch card system that paralyzed Florida and the nation in 2000, the 2006 election is shaping up into a contest not just between Democrats and Republicans, but also between people who believe in technology and those who fear machines cannot be trusted to count votes in a closely divided democracy. That's kind of a lot of BS, but I think it's an important story, and I think for more, you can always go to blackboxvoting.org for the real deal on electronic voting, and you can check out votesmart.org for information on every candidate, issue, and initiative under the sun. And this time next week, America could be a very interesting place because the elections are coming up Tuesday. We're going to hear an appropriate song. We got the Wayne Mattson talk coming up in just a few minutes, but I had it scheduled. We're going to listen to Electioneering by Radiohead. It's Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. by Radiohead. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, and now it's the moment we've all been waiting for. This is an exclusive for Media Monarchy. I went Wednesday night and recorded this just for you. Wayne Mattson in Portland. Investigative journalist and syndicated columnist Wayne Mattson of WayneMattsonReport.com is on a tour of the Pacific Northwest to promote his latest book, Jaded Tasks: Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. Mattson has written for Wired, Village Voice, Miami Herald, and Counterpunch. He's been on 2020, Nightline, 60 Minutes, Hannity and Combs, and was featured in the documentary Bush Family Fortunes. Now he's going to be at 23rd Avenue Books tonight at 7 o'clock. Now we're going to listen to the recording of him at the First Unitarian Church Wednesday night in Portland, a Media Monarchy exclusive. Here's Wayne Mattson.
And without further ado, Mr. Wayne Mattson.
Well, thank you, dearly beloved. We gather here. Wrong speech. Hopefully, next Wednesday, we won't be doing a eulogy. The sense I'm getting in Washington is right now. There's a lot of people that are worried. People say, how do you think the election's going to go? And I say, well, you know, the big caveat, of course, are the election machines and the tabulating of the votes. And I would say that there's going to be a lot of voter fraud. We already hear it. It's happening in Florida. It's happening in Maryland. There's all kinds of problems now with flipping votes for the Democratic candidates or the Republicans on the touchscreen machines. But if we get a big turnout in numbers, it's just a mere fact. How many votes can they possibly steal? And I think that's what we're looking at. There's going to be theft and there's going to be fraud, but hopefully the numbers, the people that turn out, will be able to inundate even their fraudulent system. So either this time next week we'll be looking at changing things, or we will be pulling the last life support on this country, because this is it. I mean, I thought 2004 was it, but this is the big one, because if they steal this one, I think it's pretty much over. I don't know how much longer I can stay in Washington as this sort of independent insider, because it is very difficult. You, the noise machine with the Republican neocon media is absolutely incredible. It's very hard to pierce that artificial bubble around what we call the Beltway in Washington and get through that bubble to the rest of the country, the rest of the world, to let them know, hey, what you're hearing about the Foley thing on these 24/7 news media channels is not what is going on. It's much bigger than Foley, and it has been for quite some time. But anyway, on the book, Jaded Tasks, I want to thank the United States Army for helping me come up with the name of the book, because I had the book written, but I didn't really have a working title for it. Then all of a sudden, in 2004, the United States, for the second time, overthrew the democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in a military coup. And that coup was basically formulated and planned as a covert operation by U.S. Special Forces, which we just heard about, in the neighboring Dominican Republic. And the name of the covert operation was called Operation Jaded Task. This is perfect. They're all jaded tasks. So that's how I came up with the title, just to make sure I understood what. Now, you know, the thing is about when they assign a covert term to an operation, a covert term to a covert operation. The rules are it can't have anything to do with the actual operation. It's a masking term. It's the camouflage, what it really is. So I said either somebody made a terrible mistake by calling it Operation Jaded Task, or somebody in the U.S. Army has a great sense of humor. But anyway, jaded is defined in the dictionary as cynically or pretentiously callous. And that's a great term for the Bush administration, the Bush family, and all of their cohorts and colleagues in crime. What I tried to do in the book was bring together a lot of different events that have taken place where the Bush administration has just really pushed the envelope. And I came up with this term. You know, every week would go by, there would be another scandal, either involving Bush or Rumsfeld or Jerry Bremer with the Coalition Provisional Authority, or these criminals in Congress, Duke Cunningham, Bob Ney. And, you know, every week we were just inundated with another scandal. And I talked to my colleagues in Washington, my friends and people that I bounce things off of, and they would just shake their head. And, you know, you did another scandal. They say, oh, another scandal, another day. So I came up with this new syndrome, and I call it moral indignation fatigue. And I really think the country, and in fact the world, suffers from this because of this administration. Moral indignation fatigue. What are you going to tell me that's going to top the scandal from last week? Well, I thought there wasn't anything until just a few weeks ago with the Mark Foley situation. And I can tell you that it was no accident that scandal came out earlier this month. Now, the Republicans will have you believe that the Democrats had this information and sat on it. Au contraire. As a matter of fact, a Democratic member of the House Page Board, Dale Kildee from Michigan, said he never even heard of any of this. And he's probably the longest serving member of that House Page Board that there is. He's been on there well over 10 years. He said he never heard of any of this, even though we now know that Foley had problems as early as 1995 when he first came to the House from Florida, that Jim Colby from Arizona was implicated, that Hastert was involved in the cover-up. The fact is, why it came out in early October is thanks to some career FBI agents and career Justice Department attorneys who knew, who had been hearing about these incidents, were told about these incidents by members of the staff in the House of Representatives, and were told we're not going to pursue this by two attorneys general, Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez. And finally, they had enough. Now, did they time it? Sure they did. Because there are people in the Justice Department, the FBI, that want to see the Bush people go as much as anybody else. So these are the career people. These are not the political appointees. But and this gets into where I get my sources for the book and also for the website. There are people, rest assured, in our government, in the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the FBI, and a whole host of those other alphabet soup agencies that do not like what they're saying and will talk off the record. And they talk anonymously, and I have to sometimes go to great lengths to make sure that they're not identified. When I talk to them about what goes on inside their agencies, I do not talk to them over the telephone for obvious reasons, especially if the person I'm talking to works at the National Security Agency. nor do I email them for the same reasons. The most secure means of communication is face-to-face with precautions. And I have met sources in softball fields where the chain, we meet in the backstop area where the chain link fence is, because that if somebody has a shotgun microphone, that attenuates a signal. They can't pick it up because of the fencing. Because the people I'm talking to are professionals that know what they do on the other side. I've met people in the middle of woods, out in the middle of nowhere. I've met people in empty bars where the bar owner is a relative, and they keep the place closed, or they open up early and keep it closed so nobody else is in there while we meet. And you know, it seems like it's something out of that movie Enemy of the State, but it really happens. And it's amazing. But what's really amazing is these people who come forward, they have everything to risk. Everything is on the table. These are not people who have worked for these agencies for 2 or 3 years. These are 17, 18, 19, and 20-year employees of these various agencies in the government. And they put a lot on the table. They risk a lot to come forward. We know some of them have already been identified. People like Sybelle Edmonds, the FBI translator, certainly, and she's put together a group called the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, which is now, I think, over 100 members who were all out of national security agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA, Defense Intelligence Agency, who have come forward with information, especially post 9/11. But the other thing I try to do in this book is, because the Bush family is so well connected and have been for a number of years. I mean, this is the George W. is the third generation. Prescott was his grandfather, the senator from Connecticut, who, of course, had an interesting business during World War II, trading with Nazi Germany after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Prescott, of course, laid the groundwork for George H.W. We know all about his background. But I really wanted to concentrate on this generation of Bushes more than the first two. And I took a look at some of the brothers you really don't know much about, especially the brother, the youngest of the brood, Marvin. Marvin's an interesting character. He lives in Northern Virginia, and right outside of Alexandria. Marvin is the least known, but there's probably a good reason for it. He's really the most corrupt of the corrupt. Marvin, for example, was on the board of directors of a company called Securicom, later changed its name to Stratasec. This was a security company that had a significant investment from the Saudis and the Kuwaitis. Prior to 9/11, the chairman of the company was Wirt Walker. Okay, that's Walker. You know, Walker Point. They got a geographical peninsula named after the Walkers up in Maine. That's in Kennebunkport. That's where the Bush compound is. It sits on Walker Point. Wirt Walker III is a cousin. He was a chairman of Securicom. It's interesting that on 9/11, Securicom had the contract for security at Dulles Airport. So the American Airlines Flight 77 hijackers penetrated the security to get on the flight. They also had the contract for security for the World Trade Center. Time in and time out, you look at the Bush family and their connections to the people who were not just tangentially involved in 9/11, but were absolutely connected to 9/11, and you find Bushes everywhere. Bushes are Walkers, and it's not coincidence. If we had an FBI that actually went after real criminals, This would be on the top of their list for criminal conspiracy. This would be a RICO case like no other RICO case ever. We saw Securicom Stratasec go out of business in 2003. It turns out that the two financial backers, Hector and Eduardo Orlansky in Florida, were tied up with the mob. No surprise, Bushes have been tied up with the mob for a number of years. But the company went out of business. And just about a week and a half later, after that happened, on September 29th, Marvin's, I guess you call her a maid or a domestic governess, he has two adopted kids, she kind of took care of these kids and did a lot of things around the Bush compound, Marvin Bush compound in Alexandria. Her name, Bertha Champagne, a longtime employee of Marvin Bush. She's at home this one evening. It's about 20 minutes to 9. Marvin comes home from whatever he was doing that day, which I hate to think what he does on a daily basis. It's obviously it's illegal. He comes home and she says, "Mr. Bush, would you like to see a videotape I have of myself and President Bush?" He said, "Yeah, I'd like to see it." She said, "Well, it's out in my car. I'll have to go get it." Her car is parked in a driveway, this circular driveway in front of the house. And somehow after she opened the door to retrieve the tape, this vehicle, this SUV that she's driving, goes into gear all by itself, accelerates the gas pedal, and pins her up against this, what they call an outbuilding. It was the old Secret Service outbuilding from when George H.W. Bush was president. The son had Secret Service protection. Pinned poor Bertha up against this outbuilding, crushed her, killed her, and then the vehicle kept moving across the major street with a lot of traffic, a lot of D.C. traffic around 9 o'clock in the evening. And wound up in some bushes across the street. The Washington Post reported that under the fold, somewhere in the back of the paper. Marvin Bush, dies in a tragic accident. I called the Fairfax County Police. I said, "I'd like to see the police report." They said, "I'm sorry, that's classified." I said, "Since when are police reports classified?" They said, "Since now." I got the police report. So what I'm telling you about the videotape of this person, Bertha Champagne, comes right out of the police report. That report that no one was supposed to see. And now I can understand why. I don't know what happened to the videotape. I've been trying to find out if the police took that videotape or made a copy of it. But it's quite clear that just like with all other cases where the Bush family is involved, that you know, pretty high-level people came down on the Fairfax County Police and told them to cover this thing up. There was no obituary notice in the paper. There was no announcement of a service. And a person who, one of my colleagues who helped me investigate this story, went and spoke to Mrs. Champagne's daughter, who changed the story even from what was in the police report and what Marvin told the police. She said, "Oh, no, my mother didn't die in the Bush residence. She died in the country club, the golf club across the street." So this is the way this family operates. Should we be surprised that a family that operates like that about one 63-year-old lady, a long-term employee of one of the Bush brothers, they lie about her death? That they also lie about the reasons to go to war in Iraq, that they lie about what brought about the 9/11 attacks. The family, it's a criminal syndicate. It's more than just a family. The Borgias were a family in Italy. This is a criminal syndicate. Because it's not just the Bushes, of course, when we throw in Jim Baker, the consigliere for the Bush family. We throw in these other people that have hung on to the Bushes for a number of years. We see this as really a criminal syndicate. And one of my throwaway lines, and I've said this on some of these radio shows, is, you know, the Bushes make the Sopranos look like Ozzie and Harriet Nelson. Of course, the other thing is, I would accept a dinner invitation to the Sopranos. I would not accept one to the Bush family's residence. We can go on with the other family members. That's Marvin, the one you never hear about, good old Marvin. Then there's Neil. We've heard a little more about Neil. Because Neil was a guy who stole all that money from Silverado Savings and Loan back during the second biggest heist in our nation's history, the largest being the Enron scandal, the second being the SNL heist. Neil Bush has a education software company called Ignite, with an exclamation point at the end of that. His biggest clients, no surprise, the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates. Neil went over to the United Arab Emirates, his friends in Dubai, right after 9/11. Told them what a great job they were doing. I don't know what he meant by that. But we now know, because of revelations from Richard Clark's book and other sources, that the reason the two attempted attacks on bin Laden in Afghanistan failed, the one in December of 98 and one in May of 99, cruise missile attacks to try to wipe out bin Laden and his al-Qaeda units, they were postponed, called off because, and it was called Operation Delenda, they were called off because there were United Arab Emirates, Dubai, royal family members hunting at a lodge in Afghanistan very close to where the Osama bin Laden was located. And they didn't want to kill them because that would have created an incident. So they postponed these two attacks. We find out that the Crown Prince of Dubai, who was on those hunting trips, is one of the best friends of Neil Bush. And is a big investor in his companies. We also know that Neil had a company called Interlink Management Corporation. What was their specialty? Biowar defense, specifically things like countering anthrax attacks. Well, we can go on with this. We also know in Dubai, transferred money through Dubai, $110,000 was transferred to Mohammed Atta at Sun Bank in Florida prior to the 9/11 attacks. The connections are amazing. I told people who are a little older who remember World War II, I said, what if I were to have told you a couple weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor that President Roosevelt and his family, his closest family members, all for several years had investments with Tojo and the Imperial Japanese High Command, that they had all these joint ventures together. They were friends. They had associated with one another. And they said, well, if we knew that about Roosevelt after the attack on Pearl Harbor, we would demand them to be taken out and hanged. I just smile. I said, well, you have that situation really with the Bush family and the Saudis, who were financiers and funders of bin Laden, with the help of us since the Mujahideen war against the Soviet Union. And all the members of the Bush family have been involved. Jeff has been involved with these people. He went over after Desert Storm to cash in with the Kuwaitis and the Saudis and the Emirates before he became governor of Florida. And if you think it's safe to go in the water, I just want to read a little something that I have in the book that comes from Neil Bush when he was on one of these trips over to Dubai. This is what Neil said. He said, my father was the 41st president and my brother is the 43rd. I think that if Pierce finishes high school, this is his son. I think that's interesting, isn't it? I think that if Pierce finishes high school, he'll be the 50th president of the United States. The nightmare could continue. There are other Bushes waiting in the wings. We've got Pierce, if he finished, I guess he finished high school. Looks like he takes after his uncle, Uncle George. We've got George P. Bush, of course, he's the son of Jeb, who's rumored to be the hot Bush, you know, that all the women will go for. And there's other Bushes waiting in the wings, as well as Walkers. When you turn on that Hollywood gossip, was it Access Hollywood, I think, or there's Billy Bush. He's one of them, little guy, runs around with all those terrible Hollywood liberals that the Bushes are always railing about. He's certainly cashing in on that whole operation. What about George W. and his connections with these folks over in the Middle East? Well, if it wasn't for the bin Laden family, George W. Bush's early businesses would have failed because they were one of his biggest funders. They stuck money into Arbusto, the bin Ladens, and later on with Harkin Energy. one of his closest friends, George W., is a guy named James Bath, who was the registered agent for the Bin Laden family in the United States. He was the guy who set up for the Bin Ladens a company called Bin Laden Aviation. It's funny how the Bin Ladens were involved in a lot of airports and aviation companies in Texas starting in the 1980s. But when you realize what was going on back then, Iran-Contra and a lot of these subterranean networks involving the CIA, the Bin Ladens were right there with the rest of them, cashing in. Then we look at Enron. Enron, of course, Kenny Boy Lay. Isn't it funny how Bush forgot who he was after he was convicted? He acted like he never heard of this guy. When in fact, in 2000, the Bush campaign aircraft had been repainted. It was the Enron corporate jet before it became the Bush campaign plane. Enron had been dealing with the Taliban while they were hosting the Al-Qaeda for a number of years. September 7th, 1996, there was a meeting in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, involving Enron, Unocal, and the Taliban representatives about something called the Central Asian Gas Natural Gas Pipeline, which was supposed to go from Uzbekistan through Afghanistan to Pakistan and the Indian Ocean coast. Carlyle was involved in that too. So who do we see involved in this pipeline project? Well, we see a number of people that you'll recognize from the current administration. You'll see that people involved were people like Zalmay Khalilzad, the current U.S. ambassador to Iraq, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He was a consultant on the Unocal project. Another consultant was Hamid Karzai, the current president of Afghanistan. Chevron was certainly involved in those negotiations. Who was on its board of directors at the time? Condoleezza Rice. We also find a company that specializes in pipeline construction also involved, a company called Halliburton that just so happened at the time to be headed up by one Richard Cheney. The list goes on and on. The Taliban in the late 90s came to Houston, even were given a tour of the Johnson Space Center. Quite amazing for a bunch of people who like to think that they live in the 13th century to go to the Johnson Space Center. But the most amazing thing was what happened. Now Clinton cut off all those ties, those links, after the bombing of our embassies in East Africa in August of 98. The negotiations were halted. But no sooner had Mr. Bush come into office in January 2001, the negotiations began again, and with greater fervor. Just weeks before the 9/11 attacks, a special envoy of Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, came to Washington. His name was Rahmatullah Hashami. There had been other negotiations between the Taliban and the Bushes, but this was an interesting one because Mr. Hashami brought with him a carpet, a gift carpet, from the Mullah Omar to President Bush. And he was in the National Security Council. He was in the old executive office building. He was in the National Security Council. This envoy from the head of the Taliban, if we believe what we're told by the 9/11 Commission, which I think is one of the biggest conspiracies, crazy conspiracy theories we've seen since the Warren Commission, if we're to believe that envoy brought that gift carpet at the same time Bin Laden is planning for the attacks against the United States a few weeks later in New York and Washington. I called the White House gift office. You could always call the White House gift office and say, let me know where these gifts came from to the president. Well, this woman, she says, well, wait, what gift? I said, well, I gave her the time frame. I said, a gift carpet from the head of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Make it all formal. That's what it was called. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Mullah Muhammad Omar, a carpet for President Bush. And she said, well, who was the donor? I said, well, the person who brought the carpet, his name was Rahmatullah Hashami. And she says, I'm sorry, I can only give that information out to the person who presented the gift. She said, are you Mr. Hashami? I said, ma'am, I can assure you that I am not. But I spoke to people who were in the gift office under the Clinton administration. They said, that's incredible. They said, that's public information. So we don't know what happened to the carpet. Is it hanging? Well, you know, my nightmare is probably one. It's probably a very, very nice carpet, as we know, come from that part of the world. And my fear is that if Bush got the carpet, he actually has it on the floor at that Crawford Ranch. Of course, these are supposed to be hung on a wall, but he probably wipes his boots on it. And just when you think you've heard the last moral indignation, just a couple weeks ago, another member of the Bush clan, the former chief judge for the second U.S. court in Connecticut, court circuit, John M. Walker, this is the Walkers, the Bush Walker people, he was driving his car in New Haven. We heard a little bit about New Haven before, the home of the Skull and Bones. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan in 85. He's a cousin of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. He was driving his car and he hit with his car a policeman who was directing traffic this one evening, killing him, left four kids and a wife. And Judge Walker was not given a blood test or a breathalyzer. They said it wasn't necessary. So what I'm suggesting is one of the problems we have with this current administration is they think they are a monarchy. And we think about the founders of this country, what they thought about monarchies, about George III. I mean, isn't that, you talk about weird, Bush is talking about fuzzy math all the time. How do you go from George III to George I to George II? But we managed to do it. But they think of themselves as a monarchy. It's totally anti-American. Their mere presence in the nation's capital is anti-American. I'm reminded of a friend of mine when I used to work in the intelligence community myself, a galaxy far, far away, a long, long time ago. He was installing a surveillance system for the Shah of Iran's government. And it was right before the Shah fell. He was at this on this island off in the Persian Gulf. And the Savak guy showed up to take him to the site. And he's driving his Mercedes down the road real fast, probably going about 90 miles an hour. And all of a sudden hits this poor peasant who's, got his donkey cart and his donkey in the road. He sees the peasant fly into the field. And he says, my God, are you going to stop and see what's wrong? And he says, no, he's only a peasant. But I get the sense, and where I really got that sense was that awful comment made by Barbara Bush in the Astrodome after Hurricane Katrina. When she was asked about the people there, she says, these people were underprivileged anyway. This is really a good deal for them. I mentioned that to somebody, and I said, it's almost like Madame Defarge, who knitted during the French Revolution while they were chopping heads off in Paris. And the person I said, I told that to, said, yes, but at least Madame Defarge could knit, unlike Barbara Bush, who can't do anything except she gave us, she spawned these awful children of hers and who we have to live with, and they in turn spawned these awful grandkids we may have to deal with in the future. There's many other cases of suspicious deaths. I go into Cliff Baxter, the Enron official who was supposed to testify, supposedly committed suicide. See, the corporate media wants you to believe when they tell you it was a suicide, that's it. It's a suicide. End of story. I talk about Dr. Gus Weiss, former CIA official. And I talk about John Kuchel, the head of the Iraqi analysis desk at the State Department. Who was apparently saying there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And both these individuals, within weeks of each other, they both came out against the war. Weiss, very interesting, he used to work with Richard Pearl in Henry Scoop Jackson's office. You would have thought he was a neocon. He used to be pretty hard on the Soviet Union. He came out against the Iraq War. Both these individuals, within a couple weeks of each other, they said, the media said, they dove off buildings in Washington, D.C. Kuchel from the roof of the State Department, which is secured. You cannot get to the roof of the State Department. And Dr. Weiss from the roof of the Watergate. There's something about the Republicans and the Watergate. You just cannot separate these two entities, even with a crowbar, because the Watergate, of course, came up with Porter Goss's poker parties with Duke Cunningham. There's a lot of interesting facets involving the Republicans and the Watergate. Even to this day, you think they would have learned their lesson once, but they obviously don't. Before I take questions, I want to read one thing because it is rather discouraging when you think about how we've gone from. Past presidents, and none of them were perfect by any stretch, but when you think about President Kennedy and President Carter, President Clinton, President Eisenhower, President Truman, and some of the others, and you think about George W. Bush, I mean, it's appalling. But let's go back to our third president. And here's some words of encouragement, and they seem to like come across the centuries to us now. What he wrote in 1798 to John Taylor of Philadelphia, I feel has so much applicability to where we are right now, a week before probably one of the most important elections any country has ever had on this planet. This is what Thomas Jefferson wrote. A little patience, and we shall see the reign of witches pass over. Their spells dissolve, and the people, recovering their true sight, restore their government to its true principles. It is true that in the meantime we are suffering deeply in spirit, and incurring the horrors of a war and long oppressions of enormous public debt. If the game runs sometimes against us at home, we must have patience till luck turns, and then we shall have the opportunity of winning back the principles we have lost. For this is a game where principles are the stake. Better luck, therefore, to us all, and health, happiness, and friendly salutations to yourself. And with that, I'll stop now and...
That's investigative journalist Wayne Mattson speaking at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland Wednesday night, November 1st. He's actually going to be at 23rd Avenue Books tonight, and I'll give you that straight address more. We're going to jump to his Q&A here in just a little bit, but I got tons of news to cram through if I can get to it all. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. War Games in Persian Gulf, a provocation. This is coming from Global Research. There's a massive concentration of U.S. naval power in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. Two U.S. naval strike groups are deployed, USS Enterprise and USS Iwo Jima Expeditionary Strike Group. The naval strike groups have been assigned to fighting the global war on terrorism. Concurrent with this concentration of U.S. naval power, the U.S. is also involved in military exercises in the Persian Gulf, which consists in interdicting ships in the Gulf carrying weapons of mass destruction and missiles. Tehran considers the U.S.-sponsored war games in the Persian Gulf off the Iranian coastline as a provocation, which is intended to trigger a potential crisis and a situation of direct confrontation between U.S. and Iranian naval forces in the Persian Gulf. Now, this could set us up for another Gulf of Tonkin incident. An incident in the Persian Gulf could be used by the U.S. as a pretext for war against Iran. A war pretext incident similar to the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which triggered the Vietnam War, could be used by U.S. forces with a view to justifying retaliatory military action against Iran. So we need to keep a keen eye on the Persian Gulf because things could go horribly wrong at any moment. Jumping to the next story, spooks at Google and MySpace, PayPal, YouTube, eBay, and Yahoo. This is coming from Kurt Nemo at KurtNemo.com. It comes as no surprise that Google is in bed with the CIA, or rather, it is no surprise the CIA ate Google and has turned it into yet another front company. A former clandestine services officer for the CIA who also maintains close relationships with top Google representatives says that the company, quote, is in bed with the intelligence agency and the U.S. government, writes Paul Joseph Watson for Prison Planet. Even while Google presents a public image of vigorously protecting its users' privacy, it has quietly provided assistance to several U.S. intelligence agencies such as the CIA, the DIA, as the U.S. prosecutes its war on terrorism, writes Michael Hampton for Homeland Stupidity. In addition, Google may be providing assistance to the National Security Agency. But if this does not make you paranoid enough, consider a post at Internet Portal Community Watch. eBay is run by Richard T. Schlossberg III, former graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. MySpace, of course, is now owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. According to blogger Josh Smith, the social networking site Facebook is a data-gathering operation that received initial funding from Peter Thiel, who is connected to James Breyer, who is the former chairman of NQTEL. Thiel is the co-founder of PayPal. Yahoo, the IPVW post asserts, is a possible, quote, U.S. military or PSYOP Pentagon front, end quote. Yahoo director Ed Kozel worked at Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, and SRI International. Chad Hurley, a former PayPal employee, is CEO and co-founder of YouTube. As we know, Google bought up YouTube, and Google's connection to the CIA is less than speculative. Moving on. China harvesting organs from Falun Gong detainees. This is coming from Thought Criminal. Western countries are beginning to pay high-level attention to accusations that Chinese authorities are killing jailed members of the banned Falun Gong spiritual movement in order to sell their body parts for organ transplants. A subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives held a hearing on the accusations on September 29th. The matter was also raised at foreign minister level at the China-European Union summit meeting on September 9th in Helsinki.
Co-author of the independent Falun Gong organ harvesting report, David Kilgore, was in Taiwan this week. He attended a human rights forum on Wednesday and also visited Taiwanese patients who have gone to China for organ transplant surgery. He informed them that the organs are from Falun Gong practitioners.
David Kilgore says he will update the report on organ harvesting after he has collected more evidence. Kilgore says a patient told him that he used U.S. cash to pay the Chinese hospital where he had the organ transplant surgery.
Falun Gong practitioners only who are being killed, and their vital organs are being sold to people from China and from outside of China. And it's something that the world has never seen anything, I think, quite this bad before, and it's something that has to stop immediately.
Witnesses have stepped forward since March this year, exposing that the Chinese communist regime has been killing Falun Gong practitioners in China to harvest their organs. They then sell them to patients in need of organ transplant surgeries for high prices. At the World Transplantation Conference in Boston this past July, Kilgore says he heard a Chinese doctor from Tianjin City saying the area hospitals do 2,000 liver transplant surgeries every year. Taiwanese doctor Chen Shizhong says doctors need to inform patients that a new organ does not mean the end of transplant surgery. Patients need to take anti-rejection drugs after they are replaced with a new organ. Anti-rejection drugs have very serious side effects. Chen also urges Taiwanese medical associations to deny Chinese doctors from attending medical forums and conferences in Taiwan. He also wants medical journalists in Taiwan to not publish any journals by mainland Chinese doctors on organ transplantation. At least 450 people from Taiwan go to mainland China for liver and kidney transplant surgery, but the success rate is less than 60%, and the average living time after surgery is 13 months.
You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James, flying through the news. Italian court orders Berlusconi to stand trial. This is coming from the CBC. An Italian court on Monday ordered former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and a British lawyer to stand trial on charges of corruption. Berlusconi, who was defeated in an April election, is accused of channeling at least $700,000 to lawyer David Mills 9 years ago. Italian prosecutors allege that in exchange for the money, Mills provided false testimony during trials in 97 and 98 related to Berlusconi's company Mediaset. The next story, DU death toll hits 11,000, and this is coming from globalresearch.ca. The death toll from the highly toxic weapons component known as depleted uranium has reached 11,000 soldiers, and the growing scandal may be the reason behind Anthony Principi's departure as Secretary of the Veterans Affairs Department. This view was expressed by Arthur Benklau, Executive Director of Veterans for Constitutional Law in New York, writing in Preventative Psychiatry e-newsletter. Next story, report says Halliburton unit exploited rules, and this is coming from the AP Wire. The Halliburton subsidiary that provides food, shelter, and other logistics to U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan exploited federal regulations to hide details on its contract performance, according to a report released last Friday. The Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction found that Halliburton's Kellogg, Brown & Root routinely marked all information it gave to the government as proprietary, whether it was or not. The government promises not to disclose proprietary data, so a company's most valuable information is not divulged to its competitors. By marking all information proprietary, including such normally releasable data as labor rates, the company abused federal regulations, the report says. Fascism on Google Video, the director's final cut of America, Freedom to Fascism, is not only available on DVD right now, and you can get it at freedomtofascism.com and infowars.com. You can also watch the entire movie on Google Video, and that's America, Freedom to Fascism. The next story, school safety drill upset some parents, and I actually got a lot of links to my story that I had posted on mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for this. Coming again from the AP, a school safety drill that included police officers in riot gear with weapons has caused concern among some parents who say it was too realistic and frightened some students. Police in the Western Michigan community of Wyoming entered two classrooms at Lee Middle and High School on Thursday and announced there was a threat to the school, the Grand Rapids Press reported. Students who were unaware police were conducting a drill were taken from the classroom into the halls, patted down by officers, and asked what they had in their pockets. Some of these kids were so scared they just about wet their pants. I think it's pure wrong that the students and parents were not informed of this. Moving along, lab confirms classified material found. Coming from the Santa Fe, New Mexico, Los Alamos National Laboratory has confirmed that classified material was found during a drug search at the home of a former lab contract employee. As a result, some work at the lab has been affected and security measures have been increased. Our last story, Bush reserves right to repeat Katrina failures. Coming from Crooks and Liars, in yet another egregious executive power grab, President Bush asserted his right last week via signing statement to ignore a congressional mandate that the next FEMA director have at least 5 years of disaster response experience. You would think after the Brownie debacle during Katrina last year, the president would be eager to appoint someone with qualifications exceeding Arabian horse show judge to lead the nation's emergency response efforts. Sadly, no. Because after all, his unchallenged powers as decider-in-chief are far more important than competence in keeping Americans safe.
Finally today, when there is no good news for Republicans or very little, here is one more thing. If there is one thing that you would think the White House would not want to call attention to in this election year, it would be the government's bumbling response to Hurricane Katrina and the man who led that effort, Old Brownie, as we have come to know him. Which is why I had to read it twice before I really believed the story I found in yesterday's newspaper. It said the White House had served notice that the president would not abide by new congressional rules which will require the next head of FEMA, that's Brownie's old job, to have 5 years' experience in disaster management. Why would the president have a problem with that? Well, the White House says it would encroach on his constitutional power to appoint anyone he chooses for a top government job. In other words, if the president wants to appoint someone as incompetent as old Brownie, He's going to fight for his right to do just that. Now, let's make sure you understand we are talking about Brownie. Of Brownie, you've done a heck of a job fame. Brownie, you may recall, had a lot of experience as a horse show judge and no experience managing emergencies, which is why Congress decided to write this new job description for the next emergency manager. Now, the president has every right to protect his powers, but with all the attention that this will refocus on Katrina mistakes, you have to believe that a lot of those Republican candidates in close races out there would have preferred the president leave this constitutional battle for another day, the day after the election.
That's Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation. I'm James, and you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. We're now going to hurry and jump to the Q&A session with Wayne Madsen Wednesday night at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland.
Take some questions. I mean, there's a microphone, if you need it, up here, so everyone can. So I don't have to repeat your questions, but maybe we can hear you anyway. Yes?
What's your best assessment of who was behind 9/11? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I've spoken at a couple of 9/11 anniversary functions, seminars. I spoke at the second anniversary at Riverside Church in New York, and 2 years after 9/11, I was pretty agnostic about this government involvement. I had suspicions, believe me. And any time, you know, I knew about the Carlisle meeting in Washington the morning of 9/11, where the brother of Bin Laden was there, George H.W. Bush was there, Frank Carlucci was there, all these people I had been tracking for a number of years. Carlucci, I didn't go into it because you can read it, but, you know, my suspicions about some of these players began when I went to Rwanda in 1998 to find out who shot the plane down carrying two African presidents that triggered the worst genocide we've seen since World War II. So I was still pretty agnostic. I knew a lot of things, I heard a lot of things, and from the second anniversary to the fifth anniversary, I came to the conclusion, and of course speaking to many people since the second anniversary, that 9/11 was a highly compartmentalized covert operation carried out to bring about a fascist dictatorship in this country. I see it very similar to the Reichstag fire. I see the same goals being implemented. And the Reichstag fire was blamed on the communists when, in fact, the Nazis did it. Hitler put through the Enabling Act, which tore up the Weimar Constitution. Basically, the Patriot Act and the Enabling Act are the same kinds of acts. They tore up, basically, constitutional rights that were afforded by both legal instruments. And that's the way I see it, because I think the evidence is overwhelming. And when you get even members of the 9/11 Commission saying, we feel we were lied to and we weren't given all the evidence, I mean, I don't need any more evidence than just their comments alone. Will we see anything, you know, happen as a result? One thing I'm very encouraged by is the fact that some of the Democrats running for Congress that are either tied or leading in the polls beat the established Democratic candidate in the primary. And they have issues that they want to bring to the table. Bob Bowman, who's running in Florida for Congress, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, he's not buying the 9/11 Commission report. I understand he's got cancer. He may only serve one term, but he says while in Congress, he's going to get this on the agenda. He wants to hold hearings, and he wants to get people under oath and subpoena them if necessary. And you know, we had the situation with the 9/11 Commission, and I asked Governor Kaine about this at a news conference. I said, Governor Kaine, what about some of the issues that have been put off the table by, like, the FBI on the stock put transactions on United Airlines and American Airlines and Travelers Insurance before 9/11? People made a lot of money. I said, the FBI says it's off the table. He says, well, I think it's still on the table. And then Lee Hamilton, his co-chairman, said, I reject the premise of your question. well, it wasn't a question, it's fact that these transactions were made. Cain was also asked about minders being present when his investigators, which were all run by Phil Zelikow, who's, you know, he's a Condoleezza Rice person, right? He was asked about minders being present when they went to the CIA and FBI and NSA people and asked them these questions. And he said he didn't like the minders. He didn't like them there. And he said, are they still there? It was halfway through their commission. They had 6 months left before the report. And he said, yeah, we still have the minders, and I still don't like them. So after I saw the thing when Hamilton corrected him about the stock puts, I caught him after the news conference. I said, Governor Cain, I said, is Lee Hamilton your minder? And he goes, oh, no, Lee's a fine man, you know. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions. Max Cleland basically left that 9/11 commission saying he said it was a load of you know what, and he held up a copy of Forbidden Truth. He said, I think everybody on this commission should read this book. Well, what was in Forbidden Truth? It was all the negotiations about that Central Asian gas pipeline I spoke about and I write about in the book. That's what he was referring to, and he was firmly convinced that there was more to it than what we were being told. So yeah, I think now am I saying any government agencies were involved? No, but certainly people who are affiliated with those agencies were involved. There was just too many failures that day, and I think there was a lot of contractors working for these government agencies were involved. Realize one of the things that's happened: a lot of our government responsibilities have been outsourced to these contractors, and once you lose control like that, this kind of thing can happen, where people can interfere with NORAD and the FAA and the other functions that we expect to be carried out by government employees. In fact, they're not. They're being carried out by contractors. Yeah. Well, I think Cheney, of course, knew more. We know, all we have to do is look at some of the quotes. We look at what the transportation secretary said. He said that, he heard Cheney asked by this military guy, do your orders still stand about the plane coming in from flight 77, I guess it was heading towards the Pentagon. It seems like Cheney knew an awful lot about what was going on with that. And look, Cheney, if we go back and look at Cheney's background, he was in the Nixon administration. He was there during Watergate. This guy knew an awful lot about what was going on in all these scandals. Remember, he was also a congressman from Wyoming, and he was a member of the House Intelligence Committee during Iran-Contra. Guess who he gave a pass to? Cheney's one of the key guys in this whole thing. George, people say, what about George W. Bush? And they would never tell him anything. He's, because he might screw up and actually say something. We could have exposed the whole operation. Yes.
About a month ago or 2 months ago, the White House posted something on their webpage saying and comparing conspiracy theorists to those that question 9/11 with terrorists or enemy combatants. Recently, Mr. Fetzer was on Bill O'Reilly's program, and Bill O'Reilly suggested there be an investigation of people that question 9/11, the so-called conspiracy theorists. My question to you is, with the passage of H.R. 6166, do you believe that this was passed and to continue to push Americans into a further state of fear, or do you think there actually is some sort of strategic, logistic purpose to that and the buildup of the concentration camps and the tall, cool ground defenses?
Well, this administration, the only thing they have going for themselves is the fear factor. And, when a guy, well, these bloviators like Bill O'Reilly, when they say this kind of, we need to investigate people, conspiracy people, terrorists. I mean, I think we ought to investigate Fox News and News Corporation. find out why they've been allowed to get this kind of power, you know, have SEC investigations of them. I like to I still think the jury's out on Mr. O'Reilly and his producer and the phone sex. I'd like to investigate that further. I'd like to find out if he paid his producer off. She certainly bought a very expensive condominium on the Upper East Side of Manhattan at one point in time, and then the story seemed to have ended. What did O'Reilly pay, if anything? I think, this is the thing. Why is it that the Democrats and the progressives are always on the playing defense with these people like O'Reilly and Limbaugh? They attack a guy like Michael J. Fox with Parkinson's disease. Keeping it legal, because Karl Rove does nothing really legal. He goes beyond the pale. But there's a lot of things we can do, and go on by going on the offensive. It's called opposition research. I'm somewhat heartened by some of it. I see some of it. The thing on going after this guy running for governor of Nevada, Gibbons, and this woman that came forward. That's good. We should be doing more of that. Because I'm telling you, for every Gibbons in Nevada or every Mark Foley, I can tell you there's 20 more that have not been discovered. And the information's out there. I don't know what's wrong with Howard Dean, and I don't know what's wrong with the DNC. It doesn't take a lot of money to hire people to go and dig up this stuff on these hypocrites. And I'm not saying doing it for, they're hypocrites. I mean, you got Charlie Crist in Florida running for governor, saying he's opposed to gay marriage, civil unions, he's opposed to gay adoption, then he's gay. And it's well known in Florida that he is. And so this information should be brought out on these people just to, shine sunshine, a disinfectant of sunshine on these people. Now on the House resolution, I think it's more fear that they're talking about. Yeah, the concentration, the detention centers, they say it's for illegal aliens. I'll tell you, I first heard about one of these centers down in Kern County, California, years ago. It's 70,000 capacity, right outside of Bakersfield. And it's under contract. The caretaker is Wackenhut Corporation. This is nothing new, but where has the media been on it? I wrote about the Kern County facility. There's others being established around the country. I fault the media on this. This is something that would have been so good for 60 Minutes, that, the old 60 Minutes before Katie Couric came on there. This would have been the kind of story they would have covered, but we've lost a lot of that. Now we just get the media that runs in the pack. Kerry says something and everybody's talking about what Kerry says. I get called up by people who read my website, and I know they talk to Karl Rove on a daily basis. I'm sure Karl is the one that tells them to call. And they'll try to say, oh, where'd you get this information? I say, I'm not going to tell you. And then they'll try to get me to join the pack. There was this thing about Ted Strickland, the gubernatorial candidate in Ohio, having a pedophile who had his record expunged working on his staff at somebody. It was a non-story. They said, oh, what do you know about that? Aren't you going to look into that? I said, there's nothing there. I said, I would suggest you look into Kenneth Blackwell's past, though, with something called the Leadership Institute in Arlington, Virginia. They bring these young kids in from all parts of the country to place them in as interns, and a lot of these kids are preyed upon. And they said, well, I've never heard of the Leadership Institute. I said, ask Carl. He went through it.
I'm not trying to frame this question. I think there's a range of probability that applies to some claims, fine thoughts, false flag, varying colors, will attack the enterprise at approximately 10 p.m. Gulf time in the middle of this day.
Well, yes. I mean, this the issue about the strike. I think there's three or four strike groups over in the Iranian waters right now, and people expect now they call it a November surprise because they ran out of days in October. Can't be an October surprise, but I'm glad the information's out there, and I'm glad, like, Cy Hirsch, I mean, there's not many of us that, you know, are willing to go out there and talk about this when we hear this, but these, obviously, this information's coming from people in the Pentagon who are been tasked to do contingency plans for this very thing. Now, whether they go ahead and arrange for a Gulf of Tonkin situation where, you know, you have a, they stage a phony attack, the fact that it's out there, the information's out there, people are a little, some people are wise to it. I'm more concerned not about November the 6th. I'm more concerned about what happens if the Democrats do take back the House. And maybe they even get a one seat majority in the Senate, or it's a 50-50, and maybe they can get one of these Republicans, maybe one of these women senators from Maine to change parties. I mean, this is a talk, but I'm more concerned about afterwards, and then we have an incident, and then all of a sudden the right-wing media starts blaming the new Congress. You see, we've got a new Democrat, they've already taken advantage of the situation. We now have a Democratic Congress. You see what happened? And then they'll be looking at 2008. To influence that, I'm more concerned about post-election, something like the scenario you mentioned, rather than actually before. Because I think it's going to be kind of clear to a lot of people if it happens right before. I mean, not that some people won't be influenced by that, but I think a lot of people say, oh, come on, you got to be kidding. No. Yeah.
You spend much of your life in D.C. I look back here, and I've watched this war in Iraq, and I saw a George Bush film, just huge one. But I saw John Kerry pretend to believe it and run on that. And then I thought, you know, how can I appear in a planet out of nowhere? Through the internet, through reading, I understand that easily these are a lot more. Yeah, John Kerry does, these people don't. You know, Scott Ritter, 1 hour listening to Scott. Well, it's a mass destruction in Iraq, hasn't been for 10 years. John Kerry is a liar, every bit as much a liar as that bastard Bush. Then I wondered, do these congressmen understand anything? Are they stupid or are they corrupt? Are they cowards? What are these people?
Well, they're all of those things. They're all those things. Yeah, Kerry, come on. You know, Kerry, he was not the kind of candidate that inspired any sort of. He isn't. Believe me, I think his time has come and gone. But he didn't really inspire anything in his followers. You know, most people I know voted for Kerry because they can't stand George Bush. Well, you know, when's the last time you actually voted for a candidate as opposed to voting against one? I can't remember the last time I actually voted for someone. I think I did, but I just it was way back in the 70s. I think it was Jimmy Carter. You're right. I mean, and then you get in this thing about Kerry and the skull and bones, and Bush and the skull and bones. And look, Howard Dean. I mean, I supported Dean. He excited me a little bit more than Kerry, but you know that Howard Dean's grandmother was a maid of honor at George W. Bush's grandmother's wedding. I mean, these people are all from the same. They're all from the same neck of the woods, which is Stamford, Greenwich, Connecticut, Darien. You know, places where those wealthy folks live, and some are better than others. To answer your question, most members in Congress, the minute they win the election, they're running for re-election, which means they're out trying to get money. And they're making compromises, and they're selling themselves. Very, very few people in Congress are not in that category. And look, even the people, we see new members of Congress coming in after this election. It's not going to be long before, you know, the lobbyist comes around. Say, hey, you want to win re-election? Well, we represent this industry or that industry. They're going to start compromising, too. I would just hope that some of the ones that beat the established candidates who are saying, we want to get in there and use this as a bully pulpit for this cause, like Bowman in Florida for 9/11 truth, Clint Curtis in Florida for the voting integrity, Patty Wetterling in Minnesota for the problem with child exploitation and child abuse, and Colleen Rowley for the issues, again, 9/11 related issues. They all basically buck the system, and I think if we can get them in, that's making a step in the right direction, but certainly we're going to have a lot of people that are going to be feeding off of the trough, and it'll be business as usual. Yeah.
How do you, can you correlate or bring together your comments about the drug stuff that pertains to drugs in the inner cities?
Oh, government involvement. Well, it's fairly certain that the Bush family has profited from the drug trade for an awful long time, and not just them, but we look at the whole gamut of the involvement of the CIA in this business going back to the 60s. You know, why was Porter Goss in Mexico? Why was he in southern Florida? And how did he go from that, being a covert guy in Latin America, to becoming the mayor of Sanibel Island? Now, everybody that lives in Sanibel Island knows that one of the most interesting catches you find off the coast of West Florida is what they call square grouper. That's nicely packaged bales of marijuana that are dumped off the coast and somehow are managed. They hit the tide right and the currents and it comes in. But the whole issue, I mean, I guess one of the most bizarre things I can recall was when John Deutsch was at that meeting in South Central L.A., defending the CIA against the charges that they were involved in pumping the drugs into South Central, and Maxine Waters, who I know, she was there. She was quite upset, and rightfully so. What I can tell you about this is something that never really saw the light of day. Another mysterious suicide, as I write about, is what happened to Mr. John Millis. Now, Bush was not president when this happened. This was June of 2000. It was during a campaign, so it was a big issue. It could have become a big campaign issue, but John Millis was the executive director for the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He is said to have shot himself with a shotgun in a seedy motel room in Fairfax, Virginia, the Breezeway Motel, known by the locals as the Sleazeway Motel. I'll give you some idea what kind of place the executive director of the House Intelligence Committee was staying in when he shot himself. John Millis, according to people I spoke to in Congress, was part of this whole issue with the South Central thing. And, you know, what Gary Webb had written about earlier, there were three investigations conducted on this. One was a CIA IG investigation. The other one was a Justice Department investigation. And the other one was an investigation conducted by the House Intelligence Committee. The first two investigations were basically whitewashes. The CIA said, no, we weren't involved in anything, and that's why Deutsch went out there to basically say, yeah, we looked at this and there's nothing there, you know, with some caveats, but basically blew it off. Justice Department obviously gave themselves, said there's nothing to this either. However, what I understand, John Millis, who worked as a CIA agent in Afghanistan during the Mujahideen War, spent 2 years at NSA on an exchange program as an executive at NSA, 13 years with the intelligence community, thought otherwise. And what happened, all of a sudden, John Millis, who really runs the committee, if you know about committee structures in Washington, the congressmen and congresswomen are not running the show. It's the staff. And we can see that with the Foley matter. It's the staff that's under the gun for that. And what did they cover up for the members? But just like with all committees, the Intelligence Committee is run by the executive director. He's the one that sees to the daily operations, makes sure the clearances and all the liaison with the agencies are conducted and the hearings and everything else. Millis, all of a sudden, when he said he thought this needs to be investigated, he wasn't going to do a whitewash. He got into a big argument with Porter Goss, the chairman, and it got really serious to the point where Porter Goss pulled his clearance, Millis's clearance, which is, this is amazing at this level. Millis was a Republican. I mean, if it wasn't for the, if he wasn't a Republican, he wouldn't have been Porter Goss's executive director. That's how it works in Washington. If you're in the party, you get the nice job. When this happened to John Millis, he, of course, being a professional, he knew he had an issue with Porter Goss, so he went to the ranking Democrat, who was Julian Dixon, and said, hey, look, I'm having trouble. We have something in this report. We have a draft, and it is going to implicate the CIA, and I'm catching heat from Goss. And Julian Dixon said, well, what are you going to do? And Millis seemed to indicate he was going to leak it. And then Dixon said, well, if you leak it, I owe the White House, it was Clinton at the time, I have to, as a courtesy, I have to inform the White House if you're going to leak it, so they're not caught unprepared. It's not, I don't want you to leak it, because Dixon knew it was Goss that was covering the thing up. And obviously Goss was covering up. The other thing I wanted to mention about Millis, there's a thing called the Smithsonian Public Seminars. Millis, a couple of months earlier, had spoken at one of these Smithsonian things open to the public, where he actually stated that John Deutsch was the worst CIA director in the history of the CIA. Now, this is a public speech where the executive director is saying that about the then CIA director, who, of course, covered the thing up when he went to South Central. So we can see that there were these schisms between Millis and the intelligence bureaucracy, the corrupt intelligence bureaucracy. What Julian Dixon did was he informed the president's counsel at the time, Charles Ruff, that there was going to be a leak. But what happened? What happened was Millis had that draft with him. It's assumed he may have been meeting the person he was leaking it to at that motel where he supposedly shot himself. The draft was never uncovered. I went to the motel, and I was told by people who lived there that Van showed up, and then the detective in Fairfax City stated to the several residents. You know, if somebody comes around and asks what happened to that man in that room, don't tell him anything. The body of Millis was taken into the county of Fairfax. See, the city of Fairfax sits within the county. It's independent on everything except mortuary services. That they use Fairfax County for that. And I spoke to the head of emergency services for the county, and I said, do you know that Millis's body was moved in, and there was... we don't know what the autopsy results were. He says, I wasn't aware that this guy was moved into my county. So there was a lot of questions about this. Postscript to it, Millis is dead. They got something out of that room. Whoever these people driving these vans. And in November, within 2 weeks of each other, the following November after the election in 2000, Julian Dixon dropped dead of a heart attack in Los Angeles, and Charles Ruff dropped dead of a heart attack in his home in Washington, D.C., within a couple of weeks of one another. Now, maybe they were in bad health. But I spoke to people. Charles Ruff was an invalid. He had some disease that paralyzed him. He wasn't able to walk. You may remember him as one of Clinton's attorneys during the impeachment hearings. He was a man in a wheelchair. But I was told by people who knew them both that neither one of them was in very bad health. Certainly there was no evidence that they were having heart problems.
Yes, I asked real quickly about the situation with Gary Webb. A lot of us were kind of confused as an actor when the microphone came out. What happened? But it was kind of strange, the situation.
Well, certainly it was, and I think anyone who has written the type of things he's written when a suicide occurs, my first reaction is not to believe it. And I believe he was even on record at one time. He gave an interview to Pacifica, I think the LA station, and said, if you ever hear about me committing suicide, it's BS. By the way, I tell that same thing to a lot of people. I say the same thing to a lot of people in Washington, some of whom you've probably seen on television, and they in turn tell me the same thing, especially when it comes to heights and buildings and things like that. We tell each other that we are acrophobic and we do not like high places. And if you ever hear of, you know, each other taking a dive off of a building, not to believe it. So, and I am acrophobic. I don't mind flying, and I've flown planes, but I have that vertigo issue. And so, if that happens, you can rest assured it's not suicide. Yeah, yes.
From your computer background, how much intervention is going on between postings places like TV Media by NSA or some other group?
Well, there's a lot. Understand that one of the new warfare areas, and I just wrote about this last week. The Air Force is now considering cyberspace to be a new one of its warfare areas. You know, they've got, you know, the air and the space, and now they got cyberspace, aerospace, outer space, and cyberspace. Air Force says that's our area to fight wars. Information warfare has been something on the books for a long time. As a matter of fact, Newt Gingrich, well over a decade ago, said information warfare was the greatest thing to happen in military strategy since the Romans organized their armies into legions. I mean, Newt Gingrich, of course, you know. But you look at the doctrine, and I've been to these conferences, and these people are very, you know, they're right out there telling you. They talk about information blockading, information denial, talk about bringing it. It sounds like they watch too many episodes of Get Smart. They actually use the term cone of silence, bringing down a cone of silence on a certain part of the internet. Geographically or virtually, this is the way they think. And so, so it works two ways. Information blockade, but you also see them talking about putting out propaganda and misinformation and disinformation. I mean, there's a State Department site that actually attacks me using taxpayers' money, accusing me and people like John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. The State Department website accuses us of putting out disinformation. And I, you know, whereas I've, you know, looked into the background of the guy that runs it, and I found out he was working for the apartheid South Africa military intelligence service with Jack Abramoff. Talk about disinformation. I mean, he put it out, and he was trying to justify why Mandela should stay in jail in Robben Island back in the 80s. And that got guys like Dick Cheney to say, well, we gotta support the apartheid government. And, but anyway, no, it's a real, there are people, I mean, you know, there are organized methods to put out this information on the net, and then there's pretty well unorganized ways to do it. You've got the government entities that do it, but if you ever start talking about things about the Middle East issue, there are foreign directed groups that also put out disinformation and misinformation, where they attack people, and that goes on. That's part of the construct now because of the information warfare. And I mean, it's not only our government that does it, our military, but other governments do it as well. The Chinese were very successful. One of the first governments to do it was Singapore's, because if they saw anything negative about Singapore on the net, and this is going back about 12, 13 years ago, they would attack the source and basically try to intimidate, you know, internet authors about writing negative things, and that's just exploded now in all kinds of ways. Yes.
Can you comment on two stories I read on your website? One was the four-star general and the avoidance of supposed nuclear man in North Carolina. And if you would, please.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. No, I think yeah. I know that you're talking. I think you're talking about General Byrne, who was the TRADOC commander. Yeah. Now there was a lot of other stuff that came out that I think people took it from my side and value added to it, which I can't control when they do that. General Byrne was basically fired. He was a four-star general. You're right. He public. he pretty well publicly broke, I mean, at least within the military, and that's kind of public because they tell their wives and wives tell their friends. But he broke with Rumsfeld. The thing that irritated Byrne, he's in charge of training, and Rumsfeld started to lower the qualifications for people coming into the Army to get more fodder over in Iraq. And Byrne, as the head of that, really opposed it, especially English proficiency and bringing in people with criminal records, bringing in people who didn't make it with the qualification exam, and even people who had mental issues. You know, we've seen what happened in Iraq. One guy killed a family and this young girl and raped this young girl. So Byrne was arguing about that. And you don't argue with Donald Rumsfeld and survive. And now there was somebody else put something out about this guy, knew something about some contingent. I don't know about that. But Byrne did argue, and he paid the price. And what they did is they set him up. They said he was dating a divorced woman. His divorce had just been finalized. He was dating some divorcee who was a government employee, not under his command. And, of course, they said they turned that into a big scandal. And that's what they do to these people. And that's why people say, why don't you identify your sources? Well, I don't want them to wind up like General Byrne. Because when you get identified, now Byrne had another thing. He was considered part of the Carlisle Army Barracks group, and these are the people at the Army War College up in Carlisle, PA, who are pretty good people. They know what's going on. They study Arabic and they learn Arabic and they study the Middle East. They get great professors up there, and they know this whole darn thing with Iraq and what the neocons were pushing was absolutely criminal. And they were called the Carlisle Group, not that Carlisle, but this is spelled differently. The Carlisle, but Byrne, because he was the senior one, the senior general of the group, he became the target. They said he's like in charge of the coup against the government, you know, against Rumsfeld. So he paid for that too, just because he was a senior guy and he knew too much because he had pretty good training from the Army War College. Now the other question was, oh, and Connolly's right. Well, this was one of the things I've tried to do with the website is there used to be a great column syndicated called the Washington Merry-Go-Round, and it was begun by Drew Pearson and continued by Jack Anderson, who died last year. But this column, yeah, there was a lot of gossip in it, but it was Washington gossip put out to, you know, a thousand or more newspapers around the country that syndicated this column, and it had its effect because based on what Anderson and Pearson before him heard, it helped bring down guys like Joe McCarthy. It helped bring down Richard Nixon and Watergate. You know, when Martha Mitchell was making all those drunken phone calls at night. I mean, yeah, okay, it's gossip. Oh, a woman's drunk, but yeah, but you know, it's the wife of the Attorney General. So maybe she knows something. And it turns out that Martha Mitchell was right on the money with those drunk phone calls late at night. Unfortunately, with the consolidation of the media and the fact that there's so many fact-checkers, lawyers, marketing people now involved in filtering the news, we don't have anything like that anymore. The Washington Merry-Go-Round is long since as dead as Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson. Unfortunately, and one of the things I've tried to do is because I am in Washington and I do go to their watering holes, I do go to some of their clubs. I don't like socializing with these people, but I sure as hell love writing about them. And that's what Anderson didn't associate. Well, Anderson was a Mormon, so he didn't drink anyway. So he was actually in good ground there. He didn't have to socialize with them. But I hear stuff, and I got this information from a very reliable source. It was that, hey, did you hear Laura Bush moved out of the White House? I said, no. Where'd she go? We went up to the Mayflower, which is four blocks north on Connecticut Avenue, north of the White House. So why'd she do that? Well, she had it with Bush's affair with Condoleezza. And, you know, I did some checking. I said, well, this is a good source, but I need to check some other people, see what they've heard. And, you know, they were hearing the same thing. And so I wrote that story, and it got immediately, I got a call from one of the tabloids, The Globe, which is all America, it's all America Media out of Florida. It's, they all own, one company owns The Globe, The Star, The National Enquirer. This was the outfit that Bob Stevens, the first guy that died from anthrax, the photographer worked for, because apparently he had some pictures at the time. Why they targeted him is anybody's guess. The anthrax thing is another, that's something I could write another book on. But anyway, the reporter from The Globe said, we've been working the same story, and maybe we can work together on this. And I know they have their own sources, and they did. And they ran, of course, ran it in their supermarket thing. And that was, I've only been contacted by people close to Rove on two stories, wanting to know where the hell I got this information from. That was one. Where the hell did you get? Now, why is Rove's people calling me and want to know where? Because obviously Rove was worried. 1.5 million people read that thing. Either, well, I think they buy it, and that doesn't include the number of people who only read it in the checkout lane, but they never want to be seen putting it in their shop, in their grocery bag, because you know. But they'll read it. So you have an audience with that kind of paper of a couple million people, mostly you know, housewives who read that stuff and believe it. They've only been sued once successfully by Carol Burnett anyway. So they don't have a terrible track record. And they did break the story on Lewinsky and some other things. So they did beat the major media on some things. So so anyway, they ran a story, and now I was asked, they said, well, what kind of affair is George Bush having with Condoleezza Rice? And I thought about it, and I said, well, the visual's bad enough, but it can't be anything what you would consider normal. It has to be rather aberrant. And I said, I just keep thinking about King Edward VIII and Wallace Warfield Simpson is the only thing I can think of about that. It can't be any, you know, whatever it is. But yeah, there's a lot to that. And Laura's having a real rough problem. I know people with the White House press corps. You know, she comes down and bumps cigarettes off of them, the ones that smoke. Laura's having a real rough time, and because you know he's drinking again, has been for a couple of years. If you ever, you know, you remember the pretzel thing. That had nothing to do with a pretzel, but I can guarantee you it had a lot to do with Jim Beam. Oh, okay. Thank you.
And we'll bring him back here, too. And then also, he's going to be at 23rd Avenue Books on Friday night. It's 7 o'clock, and he'll be out here for a little bit. We'll, you know, we've got some of his books, and if you people want to get any signed books or anything like that. And thank you all for coming. Tell folks, and we'll see you again. Yeah, he's going to be on Channel 11 tomorrow too at 7 o'clock, and then we'll be at 23rd Avenue Books at 7 on Friday. Thank you.
Investigative journalist and syndicated columnist Wayne Madsen speaking at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland on Wednesday night, November 1st. And that's an exclusive brought to you by Media Monarchy. I went and recorded it just for you. That's going to do it for this edition of Media Monarchy. I want to thank you for listening and thank the Portland Radio Authority for letting me do this. I'll be back next Friday at 10 a.m. And I shudder to think at the amount of news that there'll be to cover. Keep an eye out for war in the Persian Gulf. You need to get your ass out and vote, because the more of us that go vote, the harder it's going to be for these bastards to steal it. And also keep an eye peeled for the DoubleTree video. That's the one that's going to come out right before the elections, I bet. And it purports to show Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon, and it's going to completely destroy the 9/11 truth movement. So we shall see. So once again, thanks for listening. My name's James. This has been Media Monarchy. Take care.
whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not along with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.